Thank you for joining us for the Pacific Council's teleconference on Nicaragua's Grand Canal. What's at stake? My name is Danielle Renwick. I'm an editor and writer at the Council on Foreign Relations, and I will be moderating this call. We are delighted to welcome Mr. Eric Farnsworth and Dr. Axel Meyer. Eric Farnsworth is the Vice President of the America Society and Council of the Americas. He is a recognized expert on hemispheric affairs. And Dr. Axel Meyer is an evolutionary biologist and a professor at the University of Konstanz in Germany, who has written on the potential environmental and social costs of the proposed canal. Thank you both for having taken the time to speak with us today. I'm going to offer some background on the proposed canal, and then we'll turn the floor over to our speakers to give their commentary. Eric and Axel are each going to speak for a few minutes to give their general comments, and then I will ask a few questions, and we'll open the conversation up to those of you on the line. In order to reduce the incidence of ambient noise, participants are muted during the first portion of the call. If you have any questions for our speakers, please feel free at any point during the call to put yourself in the question queue by hitting the star key followed by the number 1 on your phone. During the Q&A portion of this call, when you're next in line to ask a question, the operator will unmute your line and ask you to introduce yourself. So now on to the canal. 2 years ago, Nicaraguan lawmakers granted HKND, a Hong Kong-based consortium, the rights to develop a canal that would bisect the country. Work began on the project last December. HKND projects that costs will be around $50 billion and says the canal will be functional within 5 years. Engineers say the canal could eventually serve 5% of the world's cargo traffic. Proponents of the canal argue that it would bring much-needed jobs and commerce to the country, the second poorest in the Western Hemisphere. However, critics say that the deal was made under opaque circumstances and that the environmental and social costs of constructing the canal could be catastrophic. Now I'd like to invite our speakers to give their overview remarks. Eric?
Well, Danielle, thank you, and thanks to the Pacific Council for putting this together. It's also a real pleasure to join my fellow speaker, Dr. Meyer, who's a real expert on these issues as well. So let me just make a couple brief comments, if I can, roughly divided into two main categories. The first is the vision, and the second is what I might term the reality, as I would see it. And the first is the vision. This is euphemistically called a grand canal. Nothing small here. This is a grand vision that has captured the imagination of a lot of people. Truthfully, the idea of a canal going through Nicaragua is not a new idea. In fact, it's well over 100 years old. Before the Panama Canal was actually built, completed in 1914, the idea was to go through Nicaragua, and there have been attempts through the years to complete that vision. So this is not something that is just completely new. Having said that, for various reasons, of course, it had never been fully attempted or certainly achieved. If you look at some of the obvious upside to putting a canal through Nicaragua, you would find things like what the government of Nicaragua has been claiming, that this will create thousands of jobs. We can say that, you know, that'll occur or not, but this is the vision I'm talking about. Create thousands of jobs. The government of Nicaragua claims that this will double the size of Nicaragua's economy when it's fully built and operational. And we have to remember, this is a powerful argument because Nicaragua is one of the two poorest nations in the entire Western Hemisphere, superseded only by Haiti. So this is a country that really needs engines of growth and economic development, and this is one that the government has latched onto. From the Chinese perspective, there does seem to be a certain value here as well. Clearly, as world trade patterns continue to change and grow, China continues to source much of its product in terms of commodities from South America and more broadly from Latin America. Right now, a lot of that product either goes through the Panama Canal or, more likely, because of the larger ships that are required that can't fit through the Panama Canal, they go south around the Horn of South America, and that adds significant time in terms of travel to China. So to the extent that there was another option across Central America, this would be something that the Chinese would find value in. Clearly, when Premier Li from China was in South America last week, visiting a number of countries, one of his primary purposes was to develop infrastructure. And the keynote project that he announced was the idea of a trans-Andean train rail from Brazil to the coast of Peru to get Brazilian products to the coast. So this is something that the Chinese are looking to do, whether it's a Nicaragua canal, whether it's a trans-Andean rail, whether it's a rail across Colombia, which was talked about several years ago, although hasn't gone very far. So again, from a strategic perspective, this is something that the Chinese might be expected to be in favor of. And then you consider that the Chinese economy is slowing, and yet they have great capacity, at this point overcapacity, in terms of the building trades and infrastructure development and the need to put some of that expertise, labor, and capital to work. If they can do that in the context of Latin America, that would be seen from a Chinese perspective as win-win. And then the third point, I would say, in terms of the vision, is the whole idea of whether or not Panama can maintain its monopoly in terms of canal traffic. Panama is expanding its own canal right now with a third set of locks, which will take larger ships that currently can't go through the Panama Canal. But that nonetheless will be too small to accommodate the even larger ships that are projected to be coming online within the next couple of years in terms of bulk commodities and things like that. And so the idea is that, again, if there would be another canal in Central America, this would increase capacity. It would provide cost competition with the Panama Canal. It would provide significant shortage, shortening of time to market from South America to China. And it would presumably benefit Nicaragua's economy. So you have, at least in theory, a win-win scenario here. And you can see why a number of people would suggest that this is a grand canal project, and it is a massive infrastructure project. At this point, the largest one projected for Latin America. Well, that's the vision. Let me turn to what I would see as the reality, which is a lot murkier, a lot of questions. We have to remember we're only in early days. As Danielle said, this has only been a project that, in fact, has been given a green light for about 2 years, if that. Groundbreaking, such as it was in December, but really hadn't gotten that far. There are some big questions here. Dr. Meyer, I suspect, will talk a lot about the environmental side, so I'll just briefly mention that. But there are huge environmental issues here of a canal going through Nicaragua. There are huge financial issues here right now. The cost is projected at $50 billion, and the company behind it is a financing company. It's not an infrastructure company. It's not a construction company. It doesn't have any particular expertise in terms of building canals, either large or small. And so there's a question there in terms of a financing, the ability to raise the capital and put it toward the canal in a meaningful way. There are significant engineering challenges here. Those haven't gone away. They were originally discovered when Nicaragua was being considered, and later it was the canal route was changed to Panama. But there are very large engineering issues here, but no engineering studies have been done, not even preliminary studies. This is something that will have to change in the near term, presumably if the canal is ever to get built. And then if we look at it from the Nicaraguan political side, we can see that there are going to be some very significant problems going forward as well, which is to say that there are going to have to be thousands, and that's, you know, it's disputed in terms of how many, but I've seen estimates of between 27,000 to 30,000 land expropriations along the canal route. These expropriations are primarily from agriculture sectors and populations in Nicaragua, which have traditionally been underrepresented, which really haven't had much of a voice in the whole process to this point. Now, it's one thing to become, you know, to be taking land away from people if fairly compensated or what have you. I mean, there's processes for this. But you have to put this in the context of Nicaragua's own history. And we remember when the Sandinistas were last in power in the 1980s, there was significant expropriation of property that to this point still hasn't been fully resolved. The Nicaraguan people obviously remember this. And there's great suspicion in terms of what is it about the Nicaraguan government that they want the property for. And there's a lot of speculation, and that's all it is at this point, but there's a lot of speculation that suggests that, well, the real purpose behind this is a land grab to expropriate choice properties and redistribute it to cronies. Now, whether that's fair or not, my point is to say, in the Nicaraguan context, this strikes a vein, because this is something that wars were fought over, as well as the fact that if you take take Nicaragua's population as a whole, Managua, of course, the largest city, but you know there are whole parts of the population, particularly on the Caribbean coast, that have felt really don't have much of a stake or a say in government forever. And so this is yet another example of the central government coming and bigfooting its own agenda on them. And many of them don't much like that. Now, my own personal background is such that I'm focused on these because I started my career at the State Department in Central America. Nicaragua was one of the countries that I was working on in the early 1990s. And I very clearly remember the tense and difficult discussions that were had and continue to be had in some ways around property title, land ownership, justice systems, and that scab could very well be picked off in the context of the canal. So I raise that not to say that there aren't ways around that or it's not a possibility or anything like this, but simply to say that there are some big issues out there which have not begun to have been addressed. And the last thing I would say before turning it to Dr. Meyer is that, you know, you don't hear a groundswell of demand for a canal going across Nicaragua. The shipping community, the commercial, you know, actors are not writing op-eds and, you know, manning the barricades in favor of a Nicaragua canal. They want efficiencies. They want cost competition. That's all true. But you have to wonder, where is the demand for this coming from? What is the impetus behind it? And there you get to some rather interesting questions and answers. I'm going to leave that as a pregnant point and just say again how pleased I am to have the opportunity to join the call and turn it over to Dr. Meyer.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Okay.
We'd love to hear your comments, Dr. Meyer.
Yeah, thank you. This is Alexa Meyer speaking. I should start with where Mr. Farnsworth left off. My impression is, too, that there's not all that much demand for more shipping capacity in this part of the world, and also one needs to consider that the Nicaraguan Canal is only a few hundred kilometers north of the Panama Canal, so it really would not save that much time. It's three times longer than the Panama Canal, and so it will probably take 3 or maybe even 4 days to get a ship from the Caribbean to the Pacific or the other way around. So that's more than four times longer than the passage through the Panama Canal. It is true, of course, that they're planning to have a very, very big canal that would accommodate the largest ships that exist now with 15, 18, or even 20,000 containers, 250,000 tons or so, which are too large for the Panama Canal and even for the Panama Canal in its expanded version that will presumably be finished next year. But let me talk about maybe more things close to my expertise. I'm an evolutionary biologist and ecologist. I've been working in Nicaragua since I was a graduate student at Berkeley in the 1980s. So I was in Nicaragua for the first time in 1984. My interest in Nicaragua is mostly the ecology. I've been working there now for 30 years, studying the fish that live in the Big Lake, Lake Managua and Lake Nicaragua, and also the crater lakes that are part of the Pacific Ring of Fire. And that, for me, Nicaragua is sort of a natural laboratory where one can study evolution, because some of these crater lakes are only a few thousand years old, and there are species in these lakes that don't exist anywhere else. So my interest is to preserve what is present in terms of biological diversity in Nicaragua. And whatever my opinions are in terms of whether or not this canal should be built, and of course I was one of the more outspoken critics, is comes from a perspective of somebody who's been studying in this the ecology of animals in this country. But of course, from a, you know, European perspective, who am I to tell Nicaraguans not to build a canal? It's their country. And they, as was probably said already, it's the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. There are many unemployed people. And the hope, of course, is that jobs would be created and the economy would be helped in Nicaragua. One thing from an ecological perspective that I think is important to remember is just like the Panama Canal 100 years ago exactly, this canal is also meant to be under the control of HKND for 100 years. Now, 100 years is a long time in this time of global change, because it will mean that ocean levels will be rising in these 100 years. Polar caps will be melting, which is important for two respects. One is that maybe it will be possible to take the Northern Passage between China and, let's say, Boston or New York or European harbors. And also the other thing is that whatever you're planning to build in terms of locks that will be necessary to be built on the Pacific and Atlantic side would, of course, be affected in their functioning by the levels of the oceans. The other thing, and one of the reasons why I mentioned the volcanic crater lakes, is that Nicaragua is seismically very unstable, much more unstable than Panama, which is an issue, as Mr. Farnsworth already mentioned, in terms of engineering issues that are a big problem with the Nicaragua Canal. One big issue is the channel through Lake Nicaragua. These big ships will have to navigate in a channel that is 25 or even 30 meters deep. But Lake Nicaragua, although it's a very large lake, is also a very shallow lake. It's only about 12, maybe 14 meters deep in most places. And so you will have to dredge or maybe dynamite for about 105 kilometers a channel through the lake bed in this very large lake. And this was one of the critique points that the panel had. I was part of a panel of scientists that in March at Florida International University reviewed the environmental assessment study of ERM, the company that was hired by the Chinese company to assess the ecological and social impacts of the lakes. Of the canal, and it became clear that there was not much knowledge about the sediments and the composition of the lake bed in Lake Nicaragua. I've spoken to German volcanologists that know and have been studying the volcanoes in Nicaragua, and they suggest that the lake bed will be composed of very hard concrete-like material that will be very hard to dig a channel into. So these are some of my concerns that I have about the canal, and maybe some of the questions that we'll be getting, we can address some other issues.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for those introductions. Eric, could you speak a little bit to the political context in which the concession was granted? You know, one of the big critiques was that it was done in a sort of opaque manner. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. It was done in an opaque manner with unusual haste through the Nicaraguan legislature. There wasn't much of a public comment period, national dialogue, referendum, any of this stuff that might be considered for a project that is literally going to split the country in two. You would have anticipated a much stronger, longer, robust national dialogue on this, and it really didn't happen. It just kind of seemed to be announced. Now, the people I've talked to in Nicaragua, you know, they say there's nuance there. It wasn't, you know, just imposed on anybody, and it's a little bit more, you know, less black and white as I'm portraying it. But nonetheless, the speed with which it went through, I think, caused a number of folks at least to raise their eyebrows. And the second thing is, you know, the nature of the current government in Nicaragua, yes, it was democratically elected, but, you know, the current president is not necessarily held up in terms of models of democratic governance and things like this, and we know how the election was run last time in Nicaragua. And so there are questions of of sustainability of decisions, as well as questions of, you know, do you really have the public mandate to give a concession for 100 years to a Hong Kong company that really nobody much knows about? There was no competitive bidding. There was no particular process. And, you know, you might be the elected president, but, you know, how did this decision come about? And I think there are some very strong open questions about that. So, Danielle, when you talk about opaqueness, I think that's a perfect word, because the short answer is a lot of people simply don't know. But it was a surprise that something so significant was given such little public play and discussion and really went through so quickly.
And in your discussions with people in Nicaragua, what have you learned about? Is there public support for the canal? Do people feel like they understand, you know, what's going to happen over the next couple of years?
I think the short answer is no. There's a lot of misunderstanding or simply lack of knowledge. But when people begin to understand it a little bit more, there does seem to be more public dissatisfaction with the plans. Concern is probably a better word. We've seen public protests in Nicaragua along the canal route. We've seen communities politically active in a way that we haven't seen in Nicaragua since the end of the Contra Wars. And I'm not suggesting this is going to lead to any sort of violent conflict and civil wars or anything like that. But you do have public protests and you do have community dissatisfaction, which is going to have to be addressed, if for no other reason than it's on the canal route. But I think it does indicate that this is not a subject that, you know, enjoys unanimous support. And I think that, you know, as people begin to understand a little bit more about what the project is, what the environmental implications are, what the political implications are, I think it's going to be harder to build that public support in a way that's sustainable over time.
Axel, you mentioned the Environmental Resources Management feasibility study. I was wondering if you could speak on the feasibility studies that have been carried out and what is known publicly about them, and just a little bit about that process.
Okay. Well, to follow up on what Eric had just mentioned, one would expect that there would be an international bidding for a huge project like this, but my understanding is that HKND came to get the contract through one of the sons of Daniel Ortega, who met Mr. Wang in Hong Kong through some other connections. And then ERM, this company who did the environmental assessment study that was just presented in its final form to the Nicaraguan government last Sunday, they were contracted by HKND. But again, my understanding is that there was no international bidding for this. And so these are some of the concerns about transparency and lack of stakeholder involvement. So as I said, in March, there was a panel of 15 scientists that were invited to review this preliminary environmental assessment study. And the normal procedure is that there would be feedback, because this also is one of the, it's my understanding, that this is one of the procedures that needs to be followed if you want to get international financing on board or get the World Bank involved, because my understanding is that financing is not at all complete at this stage. I mean, some of the Nicaraguan media report on Italians beginning to invest money or Russians. So this sounds to me like they're still looking for other people than HKND to support this. What became clear during our review of ERM's report, and one should say that, well, ERM did not have very much time at all, only a year and a half or 2 years to conduct this environmental assessment, which is really very, very short. It became clear that many of the questions that one would like to have answers for a huge project like this are not present. For example, in the early plans, there was no mention of an artificial lake. In the final plans that were announced in June last year, all of a sudden there was an artificial lake, Lake Atlanta, that they, as they call it. And this lake has a surface area of almost 400 square kilometers. It would be the second or third largest lake in Europe, which is a huge lake. And this lake became necessary because I think they realized that to drive these locks the use of water would be so much that if they only used the water from Lake Nicaragua, the water level would drop by 25 centimeters every day, every year. And so in a lake that's only 12 meters deep, that is not very good. And so there are these engineering problems that Eric has mentioned, also the seismic instability. And the big problem in the lake is also sedimentation. There's a flow of water from Lake Managua through Lake Nicaragua to the San Juan River, which is the river that borders between Nicaragua and Costa Rica. And that traditionally, during the days of Vanderbilt, was the way Nicaragua was crossed. The idea, of course, of the Nicaragua Canal is old, and that would have been the natural, maybe the most logical way to go, but Costa Rica objected to this plan because it owns the southern shore of Lake of the San Juan River. But in any event, so from the water situation to the sedimentation, which has huge effects on the fish, but also on the birds, on the, and not to mention the difficult situation in terms of the lake being a freshwater reservoir for both drinking and irrigation, there are many, many open questions.
And what kind of, so can you talk about the worst case scenario, the worst, you know, worst potential impacts on the environment this project could have?
Shall I begin on the Caribbean side or the Pacific side? On the Pacific side, I actually went along the route to sort of get a feeling for what it would be like, because I spent a winter at the Panama Canal, and I know how big those boats are if you're in a little rubber dinghy and you're next to one of those huge ships. And these are, of course, not the biggest ships. So if you see the locks in Panama, you get a sense of how big these things are. The biggest worry in my mind would be an oil spill in Lake Nicaragua, or the problems that arise by dredging new harbors on the Caribbean and the Pacific side, where you have mangrove forests that have become very rare. You have nesting areas for turtles. Some coral reefs might be affected. These are all still very unresolved issues, how this would affect the Pacific and Caribbean coast. And then in between, again, Lake Nicaragua, presumably the biggest problem. And, of course, the other thing is that the eastern part of Nicaragua is very still unexplored, and this has largely to do with the fact that there are virtually no roads. You cannot drive from Managua, the capital, to Bluefields, let's say, on the Caribbean coast. You have to take a boat from Rama and then go down the river for a day or so. And that protects the rainforest and the areas in the east. But if you have a canal and then access roads and so on, and maybe a railroad, these, of course, would open up big parts of Nicaragua that so far have been protected by their sheer remoteness. And that is something that would worry me in terms of, well, there's a lot of illegal logging going on there already, but that would worry me because it's as soon as people can get there, and Eric sort of mentioned the uncertain property issues in Nicaragua in regards to land. When the Sandinistas took over, they took a lot of land away from cronies of the Somoza regime. It's very difficult to know who actually owns land. And maybe that we have more time to talk about this, but my understanding is that this is still a very big question mark, how you deal with this issue. Where would you resettle people? How would you compensate them? And so on. But just opening up the eastern part of Nicaragua through the canal and roads and so on would be another worry besides, again, as I said, the biggest worry, an oil spill in a freshwater lake like Nicaragua. That would be probably my biggest worry.
And this either of you can answer this, but would the Nicaraguan government have any way to enforce environmental regulations on the concessionaire? If, you know, yeah, if some of these things were come to pass, what's the legal recourse that the government has now that it's already signed over this concession?
Well, if I can start with that, this is something that was brought up in our review in March, where people that are from Panama and are familiar with the situation in Panama brought this issue up and said, well, the canal zone essentially was American and was taken away from Panama. is the same going to happen in the case of Nicaragua? Are the Chinese going to declare the zone around the canal that they will govern, patrol, protect? And how wide would it be? Because the many of the government agencies in Nicaragua would be presumably overwhelmed with this task, and this is another issue. How much money would Nicaragua actually get, and would the money go to, let's say, the Environmental Protection Agency in Nicaragua that would then patrol along the canal route and make sure that people don't settle there illegally or hunt? I mean, these are very big question marks, and my understanding is it's not answered yet.
Eric, how do Nicaragua's neighbors, particularly Panama, feel about having a new canal in Central America?
Before I do that, let me just also add, first of all, I think Axel really hit the nail on the head in terms of the environmental side, and this whole issue of enforcement is critical. You could fine the operator for environmental, abuse or what have you, but once the canal is built, it's built, and, the pristine forest is opened up, Lake Nicaragua becomes impacted. You begin to really change the entire ecosystem around the whole Nicaraguan country. So, fines could go to the National Treasury. They could go to the Environmental Protection Agency. They could even go to a Swiss bank account. But at the end of the day, that's merely an attempted remedy. The fundamental problem still exists on the environmental side. So I think it's even if they get, some sort of remuneration or fines or what have you, it's really a poor second to having the thing built in the first place. In terms of the neighbors, I've talked to the Panamanians, and officially and publicly, they welcome competition. It's like what everybody says when somebody enters the presidential race, which we're seeing about every 3 minutes here in the States. They send tweets out, "We welcome you to the race," and then they try to kill them, the next day. I don't think the Panamanians really think that the canal is going to get built, so I don't think that they're taking it overly seriously as a challenge to their own primacy in terms of canals across Central America. They're watching it with a wary eye. I think that they're subtly suggesting reasons why it shouldn't get built. I think, by and large, every monopolist likes to remain a monopolist. But let's also remember, you've got the whole intermodal transportation system across the southern United States that goes from Southern California to the Gulf. You have transportation across Mexico. You have other transportation routes by truck across Central America. You have, even now, you've got a road between Brazil and Peru, and as I mentioned earlier, people are talking about expanding that by rail and things like that. So there are alternatives already. I just think that for the moment anyway, the Panamanians are thinking, it's a vision, it's something they can talk about, but at the end of the day, it's probably not going to impact them that much. That could change, but that's where their heads are now. It's interesting, Axel also mentioned Costa Rica. Nicaragua and Costa Rica have a border dispute, which really seems to be resulting from Nicaraguan claims on Costa Rican territory. It has to do with, small islands in the middle of river, the river that divides the two countries, really insignificant parcels of land, but the Nicaraguans have, made a land grab for some of these things. Costa Ricans, of course, have reacted negatively to that. That has entered, that has introduced an element of mistrust and lack of solidarity into the Central American context. You would think that, again, a massive infrastructure project, even if it's self-contained within one country, would tend to bring benefits to other neighboring countries in terms of increased traffic flow, infrastructure, even tourism, what have you. But anything that hurts the political relations, or certainly economic relations between neighboring countries is going to work against that. It just goes to show, I think, that there's a lot of mistrust in Central America right now between neighboring countries. And I think this feeds into it. The canal effort feeds into it because the Costa Ricans and others are suggesting, we don't know who's ultimately behind this. We don't know if it's the Chinese government or if it's this private contractor. We don't know, where the money is ultimately going to. It's going to affect the environment, which impacts us, even if it's only indirectly, but it certainly impacts the Central American region. So there are some bigger regional questions here which haven't begun to be addressed. And if you enter into that issue, then the issue of mistrust, and political divisiveness, at least between a number of a couple governments, it becomes a little bit more complicated. So I think by and large, the short answer to your question would be skepticism that it will get built, but probably hoping that it doesn't.
Okay. I'm going to ask one last question, and then we'll turn it over to the floor. But can you expand on the idea, on the skepticism that the canal might not get built? And if it doesn't get built, you know, HKND still has the right to that land. Can you talk about what might happen in its place?
Well, it's difficult to know what they're going to do with the land if they're not going to. Well, first of all, they don't have title to it. They've got, you know, a concession across the country. And, you know, we'll know a lot more if and when, you know, environmental studies are released. The one's been done, as Axel mentioned, but hadn't been publicly released. But engineering studies have to be done. They have to be released. And, you know, that will determine what the route of the canal is, that sort of thing. But, you know, this goes to the fundamental question of what's really behind this. I mean, is it really, at bottom, a serious effort to punch a hole across Central America, or are there some, is it an effort by some parties to take advantage of a weak governance in Nicaragua and the ability to enrich themselves? That issue has to be put out there, the whole issue of corruption. We see what's going on in terms of Guatemala right now, in terms of Honduras, just yesterday announcements. We've seen what's going on in El Salvador across the region, not to say FIFA, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if you're an impoverished country with a strong president, weak governance, but strong president, and a contractor comes to you and says, I have $50 billion to put into your country to build a canal, you know, alarm bells should be going off immediately, because there's no absorptive capacity in a country the size of Nicaragua to absorb $50 billion without all kinds of economic impacts, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have to say, well, okay, why would somebody then seek to actually move forward with this project? And who's really benefiting? And that takes you into some different areas, probably beyond the purview of this call. But I do think that some of those issues have to at least be introduced into the conversation. I will confess, I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly not, you know, privy to law enforcement information or what have you. But in terms of what happens if it doesn't get built, I think you have to also ask, does it need to get built for somebody to get benefit out of it? And I think the answer to that is probably no. I mean, there are people who are going to do very well if this thing, even if this thing never even gets built.
Or smaller versions, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, there's talk that the Chinese just want to have harbors and airports and to develop the country touristically. I think it's a geopolitical decision by the Chinese that they're the biggest buyers of Venezuelan oil already, right? And the connection between Nicaragua and Venezuela and China, of course, is quite obvious.
Okay, well, thank you both so much. The floor is now open to questions from participants. We will take questions in the order of the queue. So participants, please remember to introduce yourself when the operator opens your line to ask your question. If you seek to join the queue at any time to ask a question, please hit star 1. Operator, do we have any questions in the queue?
The one just popped up this one moment. I'll get that name.
Okay.
Our first question comes from Richard Walden. Go ahead.
I missed about 10 minutes at the beginning of the call. I don't know if anybody mentioned this, but 50 years ago, 50, when I was a student at the Wharton School, we were analyzing a company in Massachusetts called EG&G, Edgerton, Germerhausen, and Greer. And they had their company was formed to explode underground nuclear bombs across Nicaragua to build a canal or to dredge a canal. And that was actually a serious thing. The funny part of this was Somoza had attended the Wharton School many years before I did. But this isn't new, and it's not some, you know, it's not only the Chinese in an expansionist mode doing this. This thing's been on the table on and off forever. And it was only after a protest. These guys were perfectly serious about using nuclear bombs, and they made a case for why it would be efficient. Okay, over now.
Yeah, the history is long of ideas to build the canal, because the conquistadors were trying to do this. Napoleon III had plans to do this, and the Russians, the Dutch, many people had tried this, but I all kinds of alarm bells went off in my head when I heard the Chinese were doing this, because in my estimation, they're the only country in the world right now. It's not the U.S., it's not Europe, that can do a mega project like this. I mean, think about the Kra Canal in Thailand that they're talking about building, the Silk Road, as Eric was mentioning, the railroad through South America. Nobody but the Chinese are doing this, and I see what the Chinese are doing in Africa. They're not exactly known to be friends of the environment, and if anybody builds a thing like this these days, it would be the Chinese, in my estimation.
I think that's absolutely right. One point in terms of the nuclear issues, this actually came up in the Panama Canal negotiations as well. And in fact, if you read the Panama Canal treaties from 1979, there is actually a prohibition in there that the United States agreed with Panama that any expansion of the Panama Canal could not be done with nuclear devices. So you're absolutely right. This came up. I think that issue has probably been discarded. In the case of Panama, anyway, it's against the treaty. Who's to say what they'll end up doing in Nicaragua? But but it's an issue whose time has probably passed. Let's hope it's passed.
Yes, I think so.
Operator, is there anybody else on the line?
Oh, yes, we have a question from James Lee. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes, this is James Lee calling from New York, and just a couple of questions. If not in Nicaragua, is there some other country in Central America where some canal can be built other than, you know, other than Nicaragua and Panama? And my second question is in terms of the economics and the profitability of this new canal, is the proposed canal in Panama, is it forecast to become a highly profitable, you know, business? I mean, like, will they be able to offer some tariffs that are they're going to be lower price than the tariffs that are offered by the canal in Panama? I mean, how they propose to make money, or are the Chinese doing this even if it is not going to be possible because it is for some geopolitical reasons?
Let me see if I can jump in here quickly to offer a couple quick thoughts. So in terms of the second question, that's part of the reason why there's a lot of skepticism around the canal. There haven't been economic projections that have been made. I mean, all of the pre-building phases that you would normally anticipate, certainly for a project of this size, simply haven't been done. So we don't know under what projections they're making in terms of future traffic, future loads, future costs, operating expenses. And, you know, Axel also mentioned, you know, you're talking about a concession going out over 100 years when economies are going to change dramatically. How can you project tomorrow, much less 100 years from now? So, I mean, these things haven't been considered. One thing that, you know, a lot of people assume is if the canal is built and it's able to take larger ships, then it will siphon off some of the traffic from the Panama Canal, and then competition as well would probably drive cost to go across either canal lower. But, again, that's speculation. We just don't know. The first question in terms of are there alternative routes, you know, Panama is the narrowest point of the isthmus, which is one of the reasons why it was chosen. If you go up further north, even from Nicaragua, you begin to widen out across the isthmus even more. And so increased land, by definition, makes it more expensive, more complicated, et cetera, et cetera. There are any number of efforts to try to build infrastructure across the isthmus, which is not a canal, but rather rail, intermodal, trucking, Certainly Central America needs a huge amount of infrastructure investment, not just east-west, but also north-south. But, you know, as soon as Nicaragua announced plans for a canal, you heard Guatemala try to get into the mix. You heard El Salvador and Honduras talk about moving across their own borders. So, I mean, there's a lot of discussion at this point. But again, you have to go back to the fundamental question. Is this needed based on commercial traffic and projections? And you know, if it is needed, then would the cost to build it be more or less than the projected benefit? And nobody's done those studies, and for that reason, my money is on the Panamanians continuing to operate their expanded canal, and for the most part, that really remaining the one primary route across the isthmus.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I've heard some numbers that they would anticipate getting 300 ships or so per year across the canal in Nicaragua, and that they might get $1 million per boat. So that say, or maybe even numbers in the range of $3 billion in revenues per year. But that's only about 2% of the investment. That's not a very high return on investment, not considering the cost for to operate it. So economically, it just doesn't seem to make very much sense at all.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on the line?
One other complicating factor is more of a trivia point at this point, but one other complicating factor is that China and Nicaragua actually don't even have diplomatic relations. Nicaragua does not recognize China. They recognize Taiwan. And so, you know, that's another element we have to throw into the mix. I'm not sure how it plays necessarily or if it even matters, but it is something that to keep in mind.
Yeah, but maybe this is a way for mainland China to become diplomatically recognized by Nicaragua.
Well, that suggestion has been made. That's right.
What do you understand to be the Chinese government's relationship with HKMD?
Actually, you take that one.
Well, what I've heard is that one of the sons of Daniel Ortega, I think I mentioned this already, met Mr. Wang, and that this connection came through that. Mr. Wang has a contract and has a company in Nicaragua to build a mobile telephone network, but that was never built. I think there's an empty building that belongs to his company that's been there for 2 or 3 years. What I've heard is that there was a government or a delegation by Nicaraguan interests, maybe business people and government people, in November 2013 that visited Hong Kong and visited HKMD, and that there were a lot of Chinese government and military officials always around. So it seems as if HKMD certainly has the backing of the Chinese government. And a project of this scale, it would seem hard to believe that the Chinese government is not behind it, I would think, speaking as an ecologist.
I would agree with that.
Okay. Operator, do we have anybody else on the line? Otherwise, I'll just ask a few last questions.
We do have one from Mark Capilano. Go ahead.
Great.
Yeah, hi. This is Mark Capilano. I'm in Los Angeles. I was just in Nicaragua a month ago, and I looked at some of these sites, and I was on the Brita Beach, which is the Pacific side. Just a beautiful, dry, tropical forest with, you know, estuary going right to the ocean. It was phenomenal. I guess my question is, are there any international laws in terms of restricting the movement of indigenous people that could come into play here with, be it land rights or land ownership? Because I even saw communities that lived in that one particular area of the Pacific. Where do they go? Do they have any rights of claims of land, et cetera?
My understanding is that the people that live there are not indigenous people, but these are sort of subsistence farmers. The biggest problem I see in the Brito side is the mangrove forest that you probably saw on the southern side of the Brito River. That is supposed to become protected and taken into consideration. I think the issue of indigenous people is a bigger problem on the eastern side, the Rama and all kinds of other indigenous people. And my understanding is that there are something like 30 lawsuits that have been filed on their behalf.
And then which agencies file those lawsuits? How do they have the wherewithal to have a protest, so to speak?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. There are people that are concerned to hear these Rama people. Many of these people don't speak Spanish or English, of course. I'm not quite sure how they are represented. There are certain law groups in Nicaragua that have taken on the cause, as my understanding, have tried to represent these people. I don't know how far these lawsuits have gone. I've heard that many or most were dismissed immediately.
Yeah, it tends to be an issue across, kind of a global issue with indigenous people in general, but it's a common theme. They get disenfranchised and just kind of have to move. So I was curious about what recourse they would ever have.
That's absolutely true. It's not just Nicaragua, but it certainly is relevant to Nicaragua as well. But then you have to throw in the judicial system in Nicaragua, and does the government have its thumb on the scales of the court system, and rule of law issues, and it all becomes wrapped into the whole. It's all part of the same question. So you're right to raise the question. I'm not sure anybody has the real answer at this point.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you.
And that was the last one we had in the queue at this time.
Okay. I have just one sort of general question about the U.S. Interests or stance on having a canal in Nicaragua and having a Chinese-controlled canal. Can you speak a little bit to how the U.S. has reacted to the project?
The U.S. has reacted by not reacting, essentially. Aware, I think, of its own history with Nicaragua and Central America, not wanting to be perceived as Bigfoot in this or taking a position on a hypothetical issue that might not even, come to fruition, certainly preoccupied with other matters elsewhere. I think the United States has taken a wait-and-see attitude. The one issue that we've seen raised repeatedly by the embassy and by others in the U.S. government is the issue of the environmental implications of the canal. For example, statements that say, we would hope that the government would, complete its environmental review with great, seriousness and all this type of thing. Trying to raise questions about the canal without actually coming out and opposing it. It's hard to say what the U.S. government would do, if anything. I suspect probably not much. If the canal were to really get going in terms of the building phase and moving forward, there is, as I mentioned, a long history here. You do have to think, though, that the whole idea of a Chinese entity, whether it's Chinese government, private sector, some combination of the two, being a sole operator of a canal with a 100-year concession, in a country that has played such a prominent role in terms of U.S. relations with the hemisphere, you have to think that would cause at least some concern in Washington, not to say that, anybody's going to, use that to introduce Chinese Marines into Central America and, or anything like that. But it does change, as Axel was mentioning, it does change the geostrategic component. It's one thing to trade, for China to trade with Latin America, to buy commodities, to send manufactured products back, even to invest in, certain projects. But building and operating a canal is fundamentally different. I mean, if you look at, I know I'm going on for a little bit too long, but I think it's an important question, because if you look at, for example, in United States schools, when students are taught about history of Latin America, there are essentially two, maybe three issues that every school child is taught about, and then they're not taught about anything else in terms of Latin America, but the two issues at least that everybody knows about, or three, let's say three, the Spanish-American War, right, remember the Maine, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which wasn't really Latin America, and the building of the Panama Canal. And the Panama Canal is it goes much deeper in the American psyche than just an engineering project. I mean, this is, America coming onto the world stage. This is, Teddy Roosevelt. This is American engineering brilliance. This is all the things that we like to think we are, as we harnessed nature, right? To have that superseded by a canal built by China, in a country that the United States literally occupied for a number of years in the earlier part of the 20th century, that is symbolically a very interesting thing that I think a lot of people would comment on, and they probably wouldn't comment very favorably on. Now, the last thing I would say about that, is there anything that would be done about that or even could be done? I'm not sure that there is. That's how our world is changing. It's changing at a rapid pace. But it symbolically, at a minimum, I think it would cause a lot of concern.
Yeah, think about the artificial islands the Chinese are building now in the South.
Yeah, absolutely right. That's exactly right. Yep.
I think the U.S. can't do much about it, although it's obviously not a good thing.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much. I want to give you each a chance if you have any concluding comments or last things you want to mention before we wrap up here. I want to give you a chance to do that.
And maybe I can just briefly say that I was, like I said in the beginning, I, as an ecologist, I hope that the canal will not be built because I would be too worried about the problems for the country in terms of ecology. But, of course, I wish the country all the best. And if it means more jobs for the people and more prosperity for the country, then obviously this would be a good thing. So I kind of feel like it's not in my place to tell Nicaragua what to do or not to do.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I would agree with that. I would suggest that Nicaragua clearly does need economic development, clearly does need good jobs, but there are other ways to do that than by taking people's land by eminent domain and, building an environmentally suspect canal with, the Chinese. I think that's probably not the best way to do it. So if the issue is really jobs and economic development, and that is really what's driving the Nicaraguan administration, then let's have that conversation. Let's see how we can improve CAFTA. Let's see how we can improve relations between Nicaragua and its neighbors for trade. Let's see how we can, increase capacity in Nicaragua and the rule of law, the investment climate, the education system, all the things we would do with other partners to try to help build economic development. If there are other reasons behind this, and I suspect that there are, then you come to a different conclusion. I also hope that the canal doesn't get built, but it's certainly something that we need to watch carefully and see how it progresses.
Great. Thank you. I think that's a great note to end on. So thank you both so much for taking part in this conversation, and thank you for those of you who called in. And have a nice afternoon.
Thank you for your invitation. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.